Thanks, Kevin. I saw on our website that we have a memory verse from Matthew chapter 7, verse 2. For with what judgment you judge, you shall be judged, and with what measure you meet, it shall be measured to you again. And I don't know who selected that, but I'm sure it was well selected and for a good reason. And I thought it might be good to talk about that chapter and the general context of that verse. Everybody's familiar with it. It's a part of the Sermon on the Mount. Adam read it a while ago. Those first 14 verses he read of this chapter. In the Sermon on the Mount, the Lord has touched, on all areas of Christian life. He's given a new perspective on the way we ought to look at things, a new perspective on ourselves in the Beatitudes, a new perspective on the world, that we should be salt and light to the world, a new perspective on God's Word, which at that time was the law of Moses, a new perspective on morality, living a holy life, an inward commitment as well as external actions, a new perspective on religious activities in the Sermon on the Mount, fasting, praying, giving, a new perspective on money and possessions, a new perspective on relationships with other people. These are all areas in which the Lord's perspective is given in contrast to the view of the scribes and the Pharisees. John mentioned that you're a humble group of people, and I believe that too. But the Pharisees were proud. They were self-righteous. They were smug. But the Beatitudes said to be humble. These Pharisees and the scribes were the system. Jesus said, be salt and light to the system. The Pharisees had decided that the Word of God wasn't enough. They'd established more. The scribes had written it down. The Pharisees tried to live out what the scribes wrote and thanked them kindly for every loophole within what they wrote. They were denying the true Word of God and established their own. Jesus reaffirmed the immutability of God's Word and God's alone. So the Pharisees had an external morality. Jesus insisted on an internal morality. He's talking about character, whereas the Pharisees were so interested in just reputation. They acted out giving, praying, and fasting in a hypocritical, superficial manner. But the Lord said it must be from the heart. The Pharisees were preoccupied with money and possessions. The Lord said, you are not so to be, but be preoccupied with the kingdom and seek it first. They were involved in wrongful human relationships, but the Lord sets it right here, unmasking the inadequacy of a man-made religion. So the Pharisees were proud. They were convinced of their own superiority. And the natural result of this was that they became almost totally condemnatory and judgmental of everybody else who wasn't a Pharisee living like they did. They were oppressively judgmental. They criticized, they were censorious, and this was the judgment that they were meeting. It was their habit to judge in a very superficial manner, thinking that they knew more than they did. So Jesus said to them and of them in Luke 16, verse 15, ye are they which justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts. For that which is highly esteemed among men is an abomination to God. Their judgment turned out to often be just the reverse of God's judgment. And Jesus gave an example of that in Luke 18, verse 9. He spoke a parable with those in mind who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and they despised other people. He's talking about the Pharisees because they had set their own standard, and when you set your own standard, then you become the standard. So they looked down on everybody else, and God confronts that through Jesus with this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee, the other was a publican, and from the Pharisee's viewpoint, the publican, the tax collector, was the vilest person in the society. He was a traitor to the Jews. He was working for their enemies, the Romans, ripping the Jews off. They couldn't abide the publicans. And Jesus said that the Pharisee prayed within himself, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men. They're extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or I'm sure glad I'm not like this publican over here. He prayed within himself. He's not interested in associating with anybody else because nobody came up to his level. I fast twice in the week. I give a tithe of all that I possess. Meanwhile, the tax collector is standing afar off and would not so much as lift up his own eyes to heaven, but smote his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And Jesus' conclusion on this story was, in verse 14, that the tax collector went home justified and not the Pharisee. Just the reverse judgment of what the Pharisees would make. So the Pharisees were not only making judgments they shouldn't have made, they were making judgments that were wrong and they didn't even know it. They sat as condemning, critical judges of other people, and this, above everything else, marked their relationships with other people. A condemnatory attitude belied their claim to be citizens of God's kingdom. They couldn't be and be like that. So in this first 12 verses of Matthew 7, we have a lesson on human relationships. In verses 1 through 6, what we're not to do, and verses 7 through 12, what we are to do. This is the sum of it all. The negative first, and then the positive. One of the most famous verses in the Bible is verse number 1. Judge not, that you be not judged. So many people have misunderstood this, that we need to say a word about it. Leo Tolstoy, who wrote War and Peace and a lot of others of those long Russian novels that get so intricately involved in people's thinking that you think, does anybody ever really get in a situation like this when you're reading those novels? You don't think they do. But Tolstoy could write about the intricacies of human thinking, and he said that this verse condemns the human institution of any courts of law. He actually wrote that. We should never condemn anybody for anything. Never evaluate people at all. Don't judge, lest you be judged. And that, of course, as an attitude, fits our own time very well. We live in an age when this is one of the most commonly quoted verses in the Bible, and it finds a ready audience because our time hates conviction. Our time hates doctrine. People talk about love, ecumenism, compromise, unity, getting people together, no matter where they all end up when they are together. So probably a week does not pass but what somebody says to me in one form or another, well, we're all going to the same place. And I like to ask, really? How do you know that? What makes you think that we're all going to the same place? Because most people just believe that as an axiom, that we're all going to the same place. Somebody who talks about doctrine, somebody who states convictions, is generally unpopular and often branded as a troublemaker. We don't even want to talk to them. So we take judge not sometimes and we fit it in with the mentality of our time, with the zeitgeist, the spirit of our own age. The Lord here is obviously not condemning law courts. In the very same New Testament, Romans 13 affirms the right of a nation to judge its people, and there's no orderly way to do that without courts of law. Otherwise, you just have vigilantism and everything goes crazy. The Lord is not condemning every kind of judging or discriminating when he says, judge not. The Bible tells us, in fact, that we must discern. We must know truth from falsehood. The whole Sermon on the Mount is predicated on a clear understanding of the distinction between true religion and false religion, between hypocrisy and reality. We're not to be undiscriminating and blind, flabby, sentimentalist. In fact, in the 6th verse, which Adam also read, Jesus said, give not that which is holy unto the dogs, neither cast ye your pearls before swine. If you're going to live by that, you're going to have to find out who the dogs and the hogs are. He's obviously talking about people here. You have to know who the dogs and the hogs are so you'll know not to give them those things. There must be discrimination. Down in verse 15, which Adam stopped at 14, but if we read 15, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing. Well, if you only perceive things superficially, then the guy that's there in sheep's clothing, you're going to only perceive the wool. You're going to think he is a sheep if he's in sheep's clothing, if you don't look beneath the surface. You'll only see the wool and you won't realize that there's a wolf under there. So the Lord is telling us that there must be judgment, or we don't know who the dogs and the hogs and the wolves are in order to avoid them. In this very passage, We're told to test, to evaluate, to discriminate between the true and the false. On over in chapter 18, he tells the church to confront a sinning brother. Do it boldly, do it publicly, if he doesn't repent. In the first chapter of Galatians, Paul says, if anybody preaches another gospel, let him be accursed. John says that if somebody comes preaching a Jesus other than the Jesus of the Bible, don't receive him into your house, neither bid him Godspeed. In 1 Corinthians 5, we're told to set out from our midst those who are sinning as leaven that leavens the whole lump. People were even mentioned by name as being in this category. Hymenaeus and Alexander were put out of the church because of the corruptive influence that they were having on it. So the Apostle John says, try the spirits, whether they be of God, because many false prophets are gone out into the world. Exercise your senses to know between good and evil. We were talking about spiritual gifts in the earlier session. I don't think there's ever been a time and place where there was prophecy unless there was also some false prophecy that came along after it, and it confuses people. You've got to discriminate. Exercise your senses to know between good and evil, Hebrews 5:14. So when we look at judge not, we know that it doesn't mean we're not to discriminate between truth and error. That would be infantile. It's only children, according to Ephesians 4, who are tossed about with every wind of doctrine by the cunning craftiness whereby people lie in wait to deceive. There are things we must judge. And if that's true, which it obviously is, then what is the Lord talking about in Matthew 7:1 when he says, judge not? He's talking about this critical, judgmental, condemnatory, self-righteous egotism that the Pharisees were manifesting. They were criticizing people because of the people's weaknesses, because of their frailties, maybe the way they looked, maybe the way they dressed. Criticizing their motives, which we can't see anyway. We may assume a lot of times that we know why somebody does something, but we don't really know. We're guessing. We should just love everybody and never judge anybody is commonly said today, but that's not biblical at all. Old Testament or new. Back in the 19th chapter of Leviticus, the 17th verse, it says, you shall not hate your brother. And then he explains what he means by hating your brother. You shall rebuke your brother and not suffer sin upon him, because to allow him to sin unchallenged is to hate him and not to love him. When you see a serious sin on the part of your brother or sister, it's love in you that desires a change. That's why you speak the truth in love. When you see sin in your brother and you just silently tolerate it for years, then you're hating your brother. It's love that confronts in a loving manner. It's hate that ignores the sin. Jesus judged and Jesus condemned. Think of Matthew 23. He just excoriated these people because that was the only way to get them to confront themselves. So we're not talking about that. We're talking about the ugly critical spirit of the Pharisees. And the Pharisees obviously were not the only people through the years that have had this problem. We may fight that as well at times. We're not talking about doing away with church discipline. We're talking about that personal, critical spirit. What the Lord is saying here in essence is, stop criticizing. Who are you to criticize other people? That's the issue here. Obviously, we have to discern. Romans 16, verse 17. Mark them that cause divisions and offenses contrary to the doctrine that we've learned and avoid them. To mark them, you have to mention them by name. We must make distinctions. We can't all get together on earth unless we will all follow the Lord's word. We must exercise righteous judgment. Jesus said that to these same Pharisees in John 7:24. Judge not after the outward appearance, but judge righteous judgment. But stop the carping criticism of the Pharisees. That's what he's saying. That word judge is a term in the New Testament Greek, pronounced krino, I think. And it's translated in many different ways, 15 to 20 different ways, with a very broad meaning according to context. In fact, its meaning is always determined by its context, just like many of our English words are. If I say the word bark, you have to know whether I'm talking about a dog or a tree or a boat to determine what the context of bark is. It's determined by context. So it's, the word judge is the same way in the New Testament. Context in the Sermon on the Mount is the contrast with the Pharisees. biblical context is that we know he's not forbidding all judgment because he talks so often about the necessity of various kinds of judgment. But we're not to judge people's motives. Like in Romans chapter 14, verse 13, let us therefore not judge one another anymore, Paul just flatly says, and he's meaning stop criticizing. There's no place for personal, vengeful judgments. There's no place for hasty judgments. He that answereth a matter before he hears it, it's folly and a shame to him. Proverbs 18, verse 13. You know, in your own life, when you first hear part of a story, it's easy to jump in with your judgment about that situation. But then you hear the other person's side of it, or the other side's side of it, and you get a totally different view of judgment about that situation. So you need to hear out the whole thing. The Bible forbids us to make great judgments on less than full knowledge and facts. Look before you leap. That's a good old adage. A lot of those old bromides are bromides because they've always been true. We don't always see what we think we see. I think I mentioned to you before that back when I was young, I knew some people over in another state, and a girl was going with this boy, and she walked into a restaurant one day, and she thought she saw her boyfriend back in a back booth with a different girl. And she was so mad, she went home, cried her eyes out, and was all upset and getting ready to rant and rave at him. But it turned out it was his twin brother, his identical twin brother that she had seen in that booth in that restaurant with a different girl. His twin brother. Well, she knew he had a twin brother, but she thought she saw her boyfriend back there. They looked just alike. So we got to think things through. Look before you leap. Be careful with your judgments. One of the reasons we're not so hot at this process is that we don't always have full information. We don't always see what we think we see. We're not to make unwarranted judgments. We're not to make undeserved judgments, such as in the Colossians congregation, when they were judging one another for not keeping a new moon or a feast or a Sabbath day. Those things which had already been abolished, you could keep them if you wanted to, but they were no longer mandatory. So it was unjust to judge each other based on those things. We're not to make unjust judgments like the judgments in the Old Testament who took bribes. Almost every Old Testament prophet of any length has something about judges taking bribes because it was such an easy way for them to get some extra income. Just take money to make a judgment that was influenced by the money. We're not to make unjust judgments where we're unrelenting and we never let up and we just keep criticizing and hounding people. What the Lord is here forbidding is that officious, hasty, unwarranted, unmerciful condemnation that ultimately is spawned by self-righteous pride. And then worse, we've got that judgment in our heart and maybe we go tell people about it and become a talebearer or a gossiper, which even makes it worse. To make those kinds of judgments shows an erroneous view of God. That's what's meant in verse 1. Judge not that you be not judged. Judge by who? Judge by God. We're not the final court. When we make these kinds of judgments that we shouldn't be making, then we will be judged for that by God. Sometimes people forget that they're not God. But that's precisely the bottom line of this sin. To judge the people's motives and so forth is to play God. It's to usurp his divine position. In the fifth chapter of the book of John, Jesus said the judgment belongs to the Father, and he has committed that ability to judge to the Son. So we blaspheme God by usurping his proper place in what we say. Unless there's an obvious sin that cannot be overlooked, and then we follow the principles of divine judgment with two or three witnesses and all of that. Otherwise, when you set yourself up as an authority and you're going to call the shots, you have taken God's seat. And Paul says, how dare you to do that? Romans 14, verse 4, who are you to do that? Who art thou that judgest another man's servant? To his own master he standeth or falleth. And in our general life, that's the way we need to look at this. We're not each other's judge. We get together, we try to help each other along in living the Christian life, And that's about the best that we can do. We can't live each other's lives for one another. And it's a good thing we can't, because how well do we do with living our own life sometimes? Therefore, Paul says, judge nothing before the time. He says that in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 3. With me, it's a very small thing that I should be judged by you or of men's judgment, he says. I know nothing against myself, and yet I'm not even justified by that. Because it's God that judges me, and God's going to judge me by his word. And if I'm ignorant of his word, then I'm going to be judged by his word anyway. Therefore, judge nothing before the time. Let God evaluate my work, says the Apostle Paul. Jesus says, if you will eliminate the judgments that you should not be making, then you and your acquaintances will be better off. There's just a flat statement of this made in the fourth chapter of the book of James. And it's so straightforward, I just want to read a couple of verses there. James 4:11. Speak not evil one of another, brethren. He that speaketh evil of his brother and judges his brother speaketh evil of the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, thou art not a doer of the law, but a judge. So he says in verse 12, there is one lawgiver who is able to save and to destroy. Who art thou that judgest another? Why don't we just let God's word do its work and be sure that we don't usurp God's role? Because you're setting yourself up above the law, or as above the law, rather than as one who is subject to it. Every time you judge somebody because you think you figured their motives out, or because they didn't do something exactly like you thought they should, then you're setting yourself up as God. Judge not the workings of his brain and of his heart, thou canst not see. What looks to thy dim eyes a stain in God's pure light may only be a scar brought from some well-won field where thou wouldst only faint and yield. We don't know completely about people's background and what they've been through, what they're fighting against within their own mind, their own physiology, their own turmoil of emotion. We don't know. That doesn't excuse them in God's sight, but it means we ought to be careful with one another and not play God. We don't want to have an erroneous view of other people. Sometimes people, even if we've known them for a long, long time, we really don't know. We may think we can judge because we're under a different condition than somebody else is. The Pharisees had that very feeling. They somehow thought that they were exempt. Something about being a Pharisee made them exempt from things that other people had to be subject to. So they didn't even have to live by it themselves. They only needed to appear to be more righteous than other people, because in their own minds, they were on a different strata than being in the purview of ordinary judgment. So he says in verse 2, which is your memory verse, for with what judgment you judge, you shall be judged. And with what measure you measure, it'll be measured to you again. That's something that's worth memorizing. I'm glad that that's our memory verse. You're going to get out of it just what you put in, is the idea. There's a sense in which this even operates on a purely human level. People tend to treat you the way that you treat them. If you're nice to them on a consistent basis, then when they see you coming, there's going to be a smile. They're going to be open with you. They'll be concerned about you. If you treat people in this judgmental, censorious manner, then they're going to tend to avoid you. It even works on the human level. People tend to treat us the way that we treat them. But there's also in Luke 6:38, give and it shall be given unto you, pressed down, shaken together, and running over. Shall men give into your bosom? Yes, there is a sense of reciprocation from the way we treat people. But I think the heart of this passage is different than that. Paul says it's a small thing with me how you judge me. The great element in your life, in everybody's life, is what God thinks. That's almost the whole package, is what God thinks of you and the way you're living your life. What are you doing with what he gave you? And it gets very lonely when you think about this, because we don't have each other to witness to God and say, well, I think he's all right. You should let him in. God knows everything. He doesn't need anybody's help with this judgment. So we're not indifferent to what people think. But the great element of our life is what God thinks. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Yes, we can help each other. Let the righteous smite me if I deserve it, says David. But more than anything else, we're interested in God's evaluation of our own lives. Some of us have been around a long time. We've got a lot more to look back on, so far as our earth life is concerned, than we do to look ahead to. We've got just a few more years to be filled with tears, just a few more days to be filled with praise, and we know, in some cases, that we're probably not going to be here much longer. I think verse 2 is talking primarily about God's judgment. If you say you know enough to judge everybody else on a certain point, then you're saying you know enough to be judged on it yourself. James 3 and 1 is to that point. To whom much is given, of him shall much be required. God will judge you with the judgment you use. If you're magnanimous toward other people, God is going to have a tendency to look toward you the same way. Don't all of you aspire to be teachers? Because theirs is the greater condemnation, says James. Because when you teach others, you give evidence of knowing yourself. And you'll be judged by the standard that you show that you know. By knowing it, you manifest the fact that you yourself are responsible to live it. Pharisees just had a wrong and obnoxious point of view on this. They thought they were exempt. Everybody else was going to get it, but they were the separated ones. Jesus said you'll be judged on the same basis that you're using to judge everybody else. So in the second chapter of the Roman letter, verse 1, therefore thou art inexcusable, O man, whosoever thou art that judgest, for wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest thyself, for thou that judgest doest the same thing. You prove by judging another and doing it yourself that you know better, and you'll be judged based on that knowledge. In criticizing, we assume that we're exempt from what other people are not exempt from. And going down that pathway, we miss the point. That's the wrong view of other people. Other people are not under us. They're equal to us. But if you're negative, gossipy, tail-bearing, critical, and judgmental, it's going to come back to haunt you. Even on a human level, it will. But especially when you face God. Criticisms are like boomerangs. You throw them out, and one way or the other, they come back to you. Unloving criticism will recoil on your own head at the hand of God. Haman built a gallows to hang Mordecai on and wound up being hung on the gallows that he himself had built. In the first chapter of the book of Judges, there was a king there by the name of Adonai Bezek. He captured 70 other kings, and in an act of complete cruelty, he cut off the thumbs and big toes of those kings. Cut off their big toes so they couldn't run very fast, cut off their thumbs so they couldn't use a bow and arrow, and so forth. And when he was captured, what do you suppose they did to him? They cut off his thumbs and his big toes. And he said, "The Lord hath requited me as I have done." And that was completely right. To judge wrongly is to play God, and it's a very serious thing. Because you'll be biased, you'll be bribed by your own tendency towards self-justification and self-righteousness, by your own pride and ego. When you don't have all the facts, you can't judge righteous judgment. You know, in early Greece, it is said that when they had a severe case to try, they tried it in the middle of the night in pitch blackness, so that there wouldn't be any faces to be seen in order to avoid prejudice. Just give me the facts of the case. Don't let me see anybody's face. I don't want to see if anybody's good looking or not, because that affects people. Man judges after the outward appearance. But we need to judge righteous judgment when we judge at all. All they would hear would be the words of the case. Montaigne told a story about a judge in Persia, and I may have mentioned this to you before. This judge was bribed, and he rendered a wrong verdict for money. Cambyses was the Persian king at the time, and he heard that this had happened. So he ordered that judge to be executed, and then he ordered that the body of that judge be skinned. And they took the skin from this judge who had taken this bribe, and with it they put it on a chair. It's sort of an upholstery of a judgment seat. Like you'd skin an animal. They took his skin off and upholstered this chair with it. And from then on, every judge in that court in Persia had to sit on that chair, on the skin of that unrighteous judge. That'd be a good reminder every time you sat in that chair, wouldn't it? To render the right verdict. But we're prejudiced by our own egos. We're made impotent by our own ignorance. And we have no business playing God or assuming that we're operating on a standard apart from anybody else. When we critically judge others, we're manifesting an erroneous view of ourselves. None of us are so good that we've not got a list of things to work on. Some of us would do well to take the time we spend criticizing other people and put that time into prayer and confession of our own sins somewhere in our closet. We need to get out of our life a few things before, as he says there, get the beam out of your own eye, and then you'll see better to get the mote out of your brother's eyes. Try to become useful to assist somebody else. Take the splinter out of his eye after you get the two before out of your own eye. Otherwise, it's the blind leading the blind. We're fallible. We can't play God. We're partial in our own favor. That's part of being human. What I call firmness in myself, I call stubbornness in you. It's the same characteristic, but it just looks different when it's in somebody else. We're just blind when it comes to a lot of these perceptions. And usually the people who see everything wrong in other people's lives see very little wrong in their own life. Self-righteousness seldom sees the wrong in itself, so it plays God. I'm holy like I am, it says. And there's no way it can help anybody else with that attitude. So we don't want to be unwilling to confront a sinning brother. We know that we need to discern and discriminate, but we need to be careful with these personal judgments that we make. First, cast out the beam, consider it, and look in a meditative, prolonged way at your own life. Consider the lilies, Jesus said. Behold your face in a glass, James said. That's the way we need to consider James chapter Matthew chapter 7, verse 3. Consider, look in a meditative, prolonged way at your own spiritual problem. And having considered it, go to verse 5. Cast it out, confess it to the Lord, get rid of it. Paul went so far as to say in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 31, that if we would judge ourselves, we wouldn't need to be judged otherwise. If we would just judge ourselves. God's not going to have to chasten it if we deal with it first. So ask God to cleanse it. Ask God to purify it and to remove it. Once I've done that, then I can move on. Then shalt thou see clearly to cast the mote out of your brother's eyes. David put it this way back in the Psalms. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and then I will teach transgressors thy ways, and sinners shall be converted unto thee. But there's no way I can do it until I've got a clean heart myself. Then my help will be the right kind of help. It'll be the humble help that John was talking about earlier. It'll be in the spirit of meekness, considering myself, lest I also be tempted. You don't come to a sinning brother from on top looking down on him. You come from underneath, lifting him up in humility. Jesus said to Peter, Satan has desired you that he may sift you apostles like wheat. He's going to find out what in you is real. Peter, but I have prayed for you that your faith fail you not. And when you're converted, strengthen your brethren. He couldn't strengthen them until he had recovered himself. That's why Paul says in Galatians 6:1, you which are spiritual, restore such an one in the spirit of meekness. Well, there are a lot of people who read judge not and don't want to discriminate between the teaching of truth and the teaching of error. But Jesus says the dogs will turn again and rend you if you don't make a discrimination about which ones they are. The dogs, apart from the dogs that worked with the flocks in those days, were an ugly mongrel bunch that scavenged in the garbage and were far from being man's best friend. The Jews considered them as unclean, filthy, and threatening. And that's the context in which Jesus talks about dogs here. The holy things were just not to be thrown to the dogs. The holy things in this context were the sacrifices from the temple. Not to be thrown to the dogs. You'd better be discriminating in your work is the point. Some will hear and respond, and unfortunately most will not. But don't continue to waste your precious truths on those who will tear it and take it without a thought of its significance and then turn again and rend you. Dogs in those days even ate people, like in the case of Jezebel. She got tossed out a window and the dogs ate her body up except for a few of the biggest bones. To be eaten by a dog was considered a curse. They were a vile bunch. Weren't And the hogs in those days weren't as domesticated as they are today either. If you got a bunch of hogs mad at you, you could be in real trouble. That was even true when I was a boy. Hog pens were muddy places. Not like the hog houses of our time at all. So you come out pretending to feed them and you throw them pearls and they're not going to appreciate it. That's the Lord's point. You don't say everything to everybody. Paul said to the Corinthians, I couldn't speak certain things to you because you're yet carnal and you walk as men. I wasn't going to waste them on your misunderstandings. Jesus didn't say everything to everybody. So we have discrimination. We have to evaluate. And that's what the Lord is teaching in this passage. We can thank God that he has been so gracious as to forgive our many judgments of other people that we shouldn't have made. He's more merciful with us than we are with each other. He's ever more forgiving with us than we are with those who fail us. Our human relationships could be amazingly adjusted if we stopped being critical and had good words for one another, except in those few times where we must rebuke, reprove, and where restoration is needed. I hope God can help us to find the right balance in this as we continue to worship and to serve him, because it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of a living God. If you're outside of Christ today and would come to him in simple trusting faith, believing him, repenting of sin, if you have anything to bring before the assembled brethren today, let us know how we can assist you as we stand together. And Kevin's going to lead us in one more song.